From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And we've been talking about how the Trump presidency, now in its fourth day, is being felt around the U.S. What about around the world? After that inaugural address in which Trump pledged to rewrite U.S. foreign policy. We're joined now via Skype by Nicholas Burns, a professor of diplomacy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He was U.S. ambassador to NATO and U.S. undersecretary of state for political affairs under President George W. Bush. Professor Burns, welcome back.
Thanks very much, Jeremy.
And let's listen to something that President Trump said in his inaugural address. He was talking about how he's going to be America first. Here it is.
We will seek friendship and goodwill with the nations of the world. But we do so with the understanding that it is the right of all nations to put their own interests first. We do not seek to impose our way of life on anyone, but rather to let it shine as an example. We will shine for everyone to follow.
What did you make of that statement?
Every country puts its own interests first. That's axiomatic in international politics. No one disagrees with that. The question is, how can a country, the global leader like the United States, be most effective in the world? And I think what troubled many people, including myself, about the inaugural speech, it was so dark. It was very much protectionist. It gave, I think, a lot of people the thought that the United States would turn inward and not be the leader that we've been for the last 70 years. And so I think the challenge for President Trump is to take his belief that we ought to look first at American interests, and of course we should, how to make that happen in a globalized world where so many of our jobs are dependent on trade, where we are linked around the world in a global economy. You can't reverse history. So I think that's going to be his fundamental challenge.
Well, let's talk about some of the places around the world where we've heard some reaction, not just to the inaugural address, but to the Trump election. The German vice chancellor said Germany should prepare for a rough ride with President Trump and said Trump's election was the result of a bad radicalization. It doesn't seem like Germany is very happy with this transition.
There's a lot of concern in Europe. Europe, of course, is closely tied to the U.S. through the NATO alliance. We have been since the close of the Second World War. And during the campaign and during the transition, and even since then, during the weekend, we've seen a lot of hostile rhetoric from President Trump and his advisors about Germany, about Chancellor Angela Merkel, who's the strongest leader on the continent. Some think the closest friend the United States has in the world today. And the Europeans are nervous that somehow President Trump is going to be more focused on improving his relationship with Vladimir Putin and Russia and not as focused on helping the Europeans contend with the rise of right-wing populism in Europe. There are three big elections this year in the Netherlands, France, and Germany. So I think that's an early issue to watch.
We're also seeing countries like Germany talk about how they may be able to fill the void if the United States pulls back and operates in a more isolationist way. Do you see that happening, a country like Germany stepping in and being the global leader on a number of issues?
That's been the early reaction over the last week. The world is accustomed to the United States playing the leadership role. If, in fact, President Trump, and we don't know this for sure, is going to weaken American engagement in the world, turn us in a protectionist direction, close our borders to whole groups of people, like he threatened to do during the campaign, Muslims, then I think you're going to see the Europeans, the West Europeans, our democratic allies, begin to think about how they may have to manage on their own. You may also see China try to fill the void left by the United States. Xi Jinping was in Davos last week. He proclaimed himself the defender of free markets, the defender of trade, the defender of climate change, because anticipating that Donald Trump would begin in a negative position on those issues. So we're looking at possibly a big change in international politics, and I fear a loss of American influence in the world if, in fact, we turn in a protectionist, nationalistic, narrow direction.
What about Israel? What do you think of the fact that one of the first things that the Trump team has been talking about is moving the embassy, the U.S. embassy, from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which would probably anger a lot of people in the Arab world?
Well, President Trump's inaugural speech, and in fact his election, is very much welcome in Israel by the Israeli government. Prime Minister Netanyahu had a famously difficult relationship with President Obama. If the Trump administration moves in the next few weeks or months to move the United States embassy, I think there'll be a furious reaction in the Arab world. It would be a great mistake. Since 1948, every American president has maintained that the future of Jerusalem has to be decided by the Israelis and Palestinians together, that we would not have our embassy in Jerusalem to prejudge those negotiations. It will harm U.S. credibility if we do it. I fear it could engender greater instability in the Middle East. I served in our American consulate in Jerusalem. I know how sensitive this is. I think it would be extremely unwise for President Trump to take this decision.
One more question, Nick Burns. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, is coming to visit Trump in Washington later this week. She'll be the first foreign leader to meet with Trump as president. What do you think they'll be discussing?
Well, first, I think it's very positive that President Trump decided to meet first with Theresa May. Britain's one of our closest allies in the world, along with Canada and Mexico. I think he'll be seeing the Canadian and Mexican leaders soon as well. So this is a good start in terms of how you prioritize meetings. You want to meet with your allies and friends before you meet with Putin. The British are in a difficult position because the British people voted 52-48 to leave the European Union. Theresa May announced in Parliament last week that she'll now put forward a plan to actually leave negotiations with the EU over the next 2 years. Britain is looking for a free trade agreement with the United States. It's looking for a maintenance of its special relationship. And I hope and expect that they'll hear positive things from President Trump.
That's Nick Burns, a professor of diplomacy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He was former U.S. ambassador to NATO and former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs under President George W. Bush. Nick Burns, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, earlier today, President Trump opened his first full week as president with a meeting in the White House with business leaders. Trump told them there will be advantages to companies that make their products here in the U.S. and a substantial border tax on companies that move outside the U.S. and try to sell their products back in. The president also fulfilled a campaign promise by signing an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. So, with the TPP dead, agricultural exporters in the Pacific Northwest, who were hoping the trade deal would go through, are asking, now what? Anna King from the Northwest News Network spoke with beef producers and hay farmers in Washington State.
In Toppenish, Washington, in rural central Washington State, hundreds of people work at a large beef packing plant. They wield large metal hooks and knives. Conveyor belts move cuts of beef along. They process about 400,000 head every year here. Right now, each carcass is worth more than $1,400. $325 comes from cow parts you've likely not seen on the menu at your local diner.
Items like tongues, intestine, large and small, hanging tenders, outside skirts, tunic tissue, all those type of items have a much greater demand overseas than they do in the U.S.
That's Jay Tyler. He's the spokesman for Boise, Idaho-based AgriBeef. He says on average, their American cattle will land in 15 different countries, mostly in Asia. Tyler was hoping that the TPP, or Trans-Pacific Partnership, would be pushed through under the Obama administration. Right now, U.S. beef exports to Japan face a nearly 39% tariff. The TPP would have lowered that and made U.S. beef more competitive with countries like Australia. But when both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump started speaking against the TPP,
it was a real blow to realize the amount of time that had been invested in this, and for not just our industry, but many industries, particularly ag industries, that are so dependent on exports, that this was going to be not part of the future for our trade.
Now Tyler is hoping that at least an agreement between the U.S. and Japan can be salvaged. Just 50 miles north up I-82 in a town known for rodeo, workers at Anderson Hay in Ellensburg pack fluffy straw into super-pressed bales. A fog of green dust fills the building, smelling of sweet summertime, even though it's freezing and snowy outside. The finished stacks are tightly wrapped in plastic for shipment overseas. Anderson is one of the largest hay exporting companies in the world, and CEO Mark Anderson says, as he understood the latest version, the TPP wouldn't have helped them at all.
Would actually have had a huge negative impact on the Japan dairy industry. One of our biggest customers in the hay business is the Japan dairy industry.
Turns out Japanese tariffs on fresh milk and dairy products from the U.S. and other countries protect small-scale Japanese dairies. If those tariffs had been eased by the TPP, some Japanese dairy farmers might have gone out of business, killing Anderson's customer base. The company grew under Obama. Despite that growth, owner Mark Anderson is optimistic about the next 4 years under Trump. He knows what he wants out of his next presidential administration.
The two places we will see a bottom-line financial impact to our company will be the immigration reform, being dealt with once and for all, and the tax code system being dealt with once and for all.
Lower taxes and the ability to hire foreign labor. Both the hay and beef plants have hundreds of workers, and they say they need more. They're worried about the wall Trump campaigned on, the one that he said Mexico would pay for. So they're waiting to see what the Trump administration will bring. For Here and Now, I'm Anna King, reporting from Ellensburg, Washington.
This weekend, President Trump said the sun came out when he gave his inaugural, but it didn't. He told CIA workers that the press invented the feud between him and the intelligence community, when in fact Trump himself accused agencies of leaking material and likened that in a tweet to Nazi Germany. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer claimed that media outlets misrepresented the inauguration. Spicer said it was actually the most watched in-person in history, more people taking public transit and booking hotels than in 2009. But side-by-side photos and stats from the metro system and hotels show that's far from true. On Sunday, Trump senior advisor Kellyanne Conway was asked by NBC's Chuck Todd, why would Trump send his press secretary out with falsehoods?
Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
on
day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts, four of the five facts.
Well, Merriam-Webster soon tweeted out the definition of facts to which there are no alternatives. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has, of course, been taking it all in. David, your thoughts?
Well, it's an incredible display of rhetorical assault on some of the things we take for granted as underpinnings of democracy. You think of rejection of reporters doing their job, rejection of the idea that there are certain facts that are fixed that we can agree upon and then perhaps argue over. And in fact, a rejection in some instances rhetorically of the value of dissent. You know, Kellyanne Conway defended President Trump's rhetoric about the CIA and other intelligence agencies, calling their tactics similar to Nazi Germany, in response to the criticism from the now former CIA director John Brennan. Similarly, she called the mass protests that occurred in Washington, D.C. and other cities on Saturday awful, without sort of a notion that dissent is part of the democratic experience and experiment.
Well, do you think with alternative facts, perhaps what was, you know, helping form that phrase, because there's no such thing as an alternative to a fact. But perhaps what she was thinking was alternative media in which this administration is vested.
Well, she may have been thinking of alternative media like Breitbart News, which is where he got one of his most senior White House advisors, Steve Bannon, from. She may have also been thinking of alternative reality. Let's be fair. If Sean Spicer had come up with other facts that make a compelling different argument, then those are perhaps different facts one can use, upon which one can construct an argument. That's not what happened here. He offered things that were untrue and disprovable in several cases from before the moment they came out of his mouth. You know, the problem with this is that it corrodes the credibility that people have before that White House briefing room lectern. Well, that carries a cost for his credibility, and yet it shows the eternal campaign that seems at the moment to be being waged from the White House. That is, that the invective against the press and the idea of us and them hasn't shifted, even as they're governing in all of our name.
Well, it was Donald Trump who brought the numbers up, as you say, at that meeting with CIA workers. It was supposed to be a healing meeting. He spoke in front of the wall that honors officers who've been killed on duty and instead talked about how his crowd was bigger than the press was saying. Former CIA Director John Brennan, as you said, said in a statement Trump should be ashamed. But the administration kept this fight up even on Fox News. Here's Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and Chris Wallace of Fox.
Take a look at those pictures. On the left, you've got the Obama inaugural crowd. On the right, you've got the Trump inaugural crowd. Which one is bigger?
Listen, that you're also not saying that that picture was taken before he was even speaking. I mean, I can take a picture
there.
Of the mall
I was
right
there
now.
In the mall. I mean, let me say, first of all, too, I think Chris. This is a ridiculous conversation.
Right.
But there were huge areas, he said.
So Chris Wallace was on the mall. He saw the huge empty areas. I was on the mall, you know, met lovely people on the mall, but there were empty swaths. Look, what are you hearing there?
You're hearing the frustration of Chris Wallace, Fox News, perhaps the most sympathetic home on television for Trump and for the new administration. At the same time, Chris Wallace, not a particularly ideological figure, expressing the frustration of a veteran journalist and experienced reporter who's looking at reality in front of him and is hearing the White House chief of staff say things that aren't true about a topic too trivial to wade into were it not for the fact that the president of the United States on down is, you know, in a lather about this and outraged about it and attacking the notion of how the press operates as a result. Kellyanne Conway said, you know, we may have to rethink our relationship as a result of questions like this. So you're seeing the irritation of Donald Trump, who likes focusing on crowd sizes and on ratings and on polls when they favor him. And at the same time, it's also an effort in some ways to strip the press of credibility, I think, when bigger issues come along, when there are bigger challenges, when there are true exposés in the Trump administration, should they be published or broadcast. And trying to indicate to his most ardent supporters, you can't believe what you hear from these folks. All of these facts are in doubt.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thank you, David.
You bet.
Well, investigative muckraking journalist Wayne Barrett died the day before Donald Trump was inaugurated, an irony not lost on Wayne's many admirers. Jennifer Gonerman once wrote in The New Yorker that there may be no journalist in the country who knows more about Donald Trump than Wayne Barrett. His 1992 book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall, was reissued last year. Tom Robbins is investigative journalist in residence at the City University of New York Grad School of Journalism. And Tom, you met Wayne at the Village Voice. He suffered a lung disease, though not a smoker. You tell us he was writing as he went to the hospital last week?
Literally. He had an interview going on while he was in the car as his wife and son were driving him to the hospital.
No. We're going to hear some of our interview with him. Very generous in the last few months with reporters, even though he was sick. And he was a reporter's reporter, like dog with a bone, spent almost four decades at the Village Voice. What was it about him?
Wayne was an old school reporter in many ways. We're talking about a guy who never owned a cell phone. And his attitude was, if somebody needs to get hold of him, they'll figure out how to do it. And he would operate from either his office or his home, toggling back and forth on several phone lines. But he was a magnificent analyst of all kinds of data at the same time. His idea of a good day was to sit on the beach and look through campaign finance contributions.
I love the description the New York Times gives in their obituary of how when he went to his son's elementary school to explain what raking muck was, he put on a trench coat, he pulled up his collar, he took out a pad, and he said, "We are detectives for the people."
Exactly.
Yeah. Do I understand he was laid off after so many years at The Voice and that you resigned in protest?
I resigned in protest and solidarity. When the new ownership, now the past ownership of the Village Voice, decided that they couldn't afford Wayne anymore and laid him off, I sort of thought that that was making a statement about the value of a really deep investigative journalism. And I figured if they don't need him around, they probably don't need me around.
Well, he had that kind of loyalty from other reporters for his work. And he also had some respect from the people that he raked over the coals. I'm thinking of former New York Mayor Koch, who he took apart in a book, said his reporting was superb. I'm not sure how former Mayor Giuliani feels about him. We spoke with Wayne Barrett last November after Giuliani made comments that he talked to current FBI members about those Clinton emails that ended up not warranting an investigation. Giuliani also hinted that he may have had a heads up about FBI Director James Comey's announcement of the emails. And Wayne, in our interview, reminded us that Giuliani was the one who drafted a law saying that agents could not talk to political figures, violating his own law there. And then we asked him what his broader thoughts were. Let's listen.
Frankly, I don't think it was ever reported before. We have never had a Democrat as an FBI director in the United States in the history of the FBI. Four Democratic presidents, including the current one, have appointed Republicans. So this is an agency that has a Republican culture from the top. So there has to be some measures taken to depoliticize the functioning of the agency. I've known public corruption agents all of my reporting career, and I think they're outstanding people generally. But some of them have clearly gotten the partisan bug and have done some things that are regrettable. I think somebody needs to be made an example of, and this problem will be solved.
Wayne Barrett last November. He died last week. Tom Robbins, was his voice still getting through? Were people listening to him?
I think Wayne had probably, you know, one of the best years of his career over the past year when he opened the doors to his house in Brooklyn and invited reporters from all across the country to take a tour of all of his old files from his Trump book. And he was picked up on, you know, your show and I think innumerable shows across the country talking about who Trump was and why he first caught his attention.
And just give us the thumbnail.
Wayne was really just starting as a staff writer at The Voice when Jack Newfield, who was a senior editor there, said, you know, I think you should take a look at this new kid on the block, Donald Trump, son of Fred Trump, who was a well-known developer in New York, because he's trying to do this big deal on 42nd Street, the old Commodore Hotel. He wants to build a fancy new hotel, the Grand Hyatt, there. And he's using his lawyer, Roy Cohn, who was pretty notorious in New York because of his association with Senator Joe McCarthy and a number of other things. Mm-hmm. And so Wayne dug in and went to interview Trump, and Trump was initially receptive and granted Wayne more than a dozen hours of on-the-record interviews. And then I think when he recognized that this wasn't a reporter that he was going to be able to really get his way with, one day Wayne got a call from him and said, you know, Wayne lived in Brownsville, Brooklyn, not the richest neighborhood in the world back in those days. And Trump said, Wayne, you don't have to live in Brownsville. I've got apartments. And Wayne laughed and said, that's okay. And the next thing he knew, he got, having been offered the carrot, he got the stick with Roy Cohn on the phone threatening to sue, which he never did.
Again, Wayne Barrett died last week. Tom Robbins, investigative journalist in residence at the City University of New York Graduate School of Journalism. Thanks for your time and sorry for your loss.
Thank you, Robin.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Poo-Pourri, the original Before You Go Toilet Spray, that uses essential oils to trap bathroom odor beneath the surface of the water. Use it next time you have to go at work or when visiting family and friends. Poo-Pourri allows you to go anywhere with uplifting, natural fragrances like lemongrass, lavender, or hibiscus. Whether at work, on a date, even at a party, you can go. Use the code NOW and get 20% off your next purchase at poopourri.com.
As President Donald Trump settles into his new job, lots of old questions remain about his conflicts of interest. Ethics experts say that trying to fill two roles at once, president and global businessman, will create many conflicts. Trump has said he can solve those problems by turning over management of his business to his sons, but a lawsuit was filed today to challenge that plan. Marilyn Gwax, an NPR senior business editor, has been following this. She joins us from Washington. Hi, Marilyn.
Hey, hello.
And let's start with that lawsuit from CREW. That's the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. They say the president is violating the Emoluments Clause, which is something we've heard about. Remind us what that is and what's at issue here.
Well, that's a clause that's in the Constitution, and it says that the president can't take gifts from foreign governments. Now, Trump has these business interests that are in something like 20 countries. And he says it's just routine business. If somebody pays a hotel bill, that's not a gift. That's just his business. He also says that he won't be running the day-to-day operations of his business and that in any case, any profits that come from a foreign government will be turned over to the Treasury. So to a lot of ears, maybe that sounds good, but ethics experts say there are lots of problems with that. So for one thing, we don't have any evidence that he has turned over his businesses to his sons. So far, we have not seen that paperwork. It may exist somewhere, but people who are following this have no evidence of it. There's also, it's unclear, how would he monitor this process? How do we know money is going to the Treasury? But in any case, even if you sort of push all of that aside, what the heck is a gift in this context? Let me just give you one example that is pretty concrete to think about. Trump owns a big golf course in Scotland. It's about to have a giant, addition put onto it, more golf, more hotels. What if the government in Scotland decides to take away those wind turbines that he doesn't like? He says that hurts the view at his golf course. Is that a gift? I mean, is the government trying to help him and make his views better than the competing golf course? How do you even measure that? It's very tricky. So this lawsuit is trying to say they've got to separate themselves from these businesses.
So how long is that going to take? What happens next with this lawsuit?
Well, this is unprecedented stuff. We really have never had a president with these kinds of global business operations. So it's new. We'll see. You know, this is going to have to go through the courts. It's a question whether or not the group that brought this suit even has standing to do so. You know, maybe this is strictly a matter for Congress. But there's a lot to be sorted out in coming weeks and months.
Also, a lot to be sorted out when it comes to his hotel in D.C., right? Which he's not supposed to both be on the lease and be a government official.
That's another real tricky one. That's another one that up until now it's been a theoretical problem, but today it's a real problem. Trump, back in 2013, signed a lease with the General Services Administration. They watch over the contracts for government properties. And he had leased this government-owned property. It's owned by you and me, all the taxpayers. It's a very historic building. It's right on Pennsylvania Avenue. And he leased it and turned it into a really beautiful hotel. Everybody says it's really, really, really nice. But the problem is that he seems to be doing things to promote that business, like, you know, talking about it and waving at it when he went by in the parade. So there's this big question. The contract is not supposed to be held by an elected official.
Right.
Don't know what'll happen next.
That's Marilyn Giewax, an NPR senior business editor following all the conflict of interest issues. Marilyn, thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
And it's the fourth day of the Trump administration, so of course we now want to focus on the midterm elections of 2018. Senate Democrats are, because they may be in trouble. Nathan Gonzalez is the editor and publisher of Inside Elections with Nathan Gonzalez, and he's the elections analyst for Roll Call. Nathan, give us the picture of the landscape for the elections of 2018, which Democrats have been looking at since the day after this election.
Right. I mean, for some people, the idea of talking about the next election is simply appalling. No one wants to go through another election. But the fact is that those 2018 midterm elections are already happening now. There are already candidates announcing their bids, like State Treasurer Josh Mandel in Ohio, a Republican. And a number of these Democratic incumbents have reelection on their minds as they take votes in this Congress. And the initial map is very good for Republicans or potentially poor for Democrats, depending on which way you want to look at it. Of the 33 states that have seats up for re-election in 2018, Democrats are defending 25 of them. Republicans are only defending 8. And you might think, well, why is it so out of balance? It's because 2012 was actually a good Democratic year. The president won re-election. Democrats picked up seats in the House and the Senate. The consequence of having a good year is you have to defend all those seats 6 years later. And
right,
that's where we are today.
Right. And you mentioned, okay, 33 different Senate seats, 25 Democrats, 8 Republicans up for re-election. But 10 Democratic senators are up for re-election in states that Donald Trump carried, which is going to have a big impact, as it did, as you said, for the Democrats after Obama won so handily. So you have a 9-point competitiveness scale that you use to rate the races. What's that about?
So we rate the races based on the likelihood that they will flip partisan control from toss-up, you know, the most competitive races, to tilt, lean, likely, and all the way to solid, which are the least competitive. And right now, of those, you mentioned those 10 Democratic states where Donald Trump won, we have already 4 of them in toss-up: Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Those aren't the only vulnerable Democrats, but I think those are the most vulnerable at the outset.
Well, you have a graph set out. We'll post it at hereandnow.org. But just go through. I'll start. You've got, for the solids, holding onto their seats in 2018, Dianne Feinstein in California, Chris Murphy, Connecticut, Tom Carper, Delaware. Continue the list there.
Maria Cantwell of Washington, Ben Cardin of Maryland, Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, Martin Heinrich of New Mexico, Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, Angus King of Maine, who's technically an independent but caucuses with Democrats, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, Bob Menendez of New Jersey, Chris Murphy of Connecticut, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, again, another independent who caucuses with Democrats, Debbie Stabenow of Michigan, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, and Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. On the other side of the ledger, in the solid Republican category, so the ones that look solid for re-election right now, you have John Barrasso of Wyoming, Bob Corker of Tennessee, Ted Cruz in Texas, Deb Fischer in Nebraska, Orrin Hatch in Utah, and Roger Wicker of Mississippi.
Okay. Then you've got the likely and the leaning. What are those?
In the likely categories, which are races to watch that have a potential of developing into top-tier races, Republican Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona and Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia.
Okay. Then you've got leaning. Could tumble.
In the leaning categories, which I think are going to be competitive races that we're going to see both parties invest money in, on the Republican side, Dean Heller of Nevada, Democratic Senators Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and Bob Casey Jr. of Pennsylvania.
Okay. Tilt? What's tilt?
I don't like to throw every race into toss-up. And so races that I think are going to be competitive but are there's still a lot to happen mm-hmm. for them. Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, Democrat Bill Nelson of Florida, and Democrat John Tester of Montana, I think are in that tilting category.
Okay. We'll talk about another thing that a Politico points out that these Democrats have to consider. They don't all have the same concerns with their voters. Joe Manchin in West Virginia, you have him in a toss-up state. He was trying to identify with Trump supporters during Trump's campaign. He was trying to show that he was one of them, but you have others who are very much on the progressive side. So the party has to look at a wide range of people to appeal to.
These Democratic senators, they're going to feel a lot of tension over the next couple of years because in one ear, they're going to be listening to Democratic leadership or the Democratic base who's going to say, we have to oppose Donald Trump on everything. He is an illegitimate president who didn't win the popular vote. And then Joe Manchin's going to hear from out of his other ear the 69% of West Virginia voters who put Donald Trump in the Oval Office. So he has to balance those. But then you have someone like Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, who Trump technically won Michigan. He just won it barely. We're not talking with the 69% of West Virginia. So her calculation, I think, is a little bit different. And then you have a whole batch of senators in between those two.
Well, you have Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii. I love this quote. He says, people agree with us, but they just don't believe in us. In other words, there are Democrats who believe that they have the issues that people care about. We're hearing more and more people who supported Donald Trump saying, well, wait a minute, I don't want to lose my health care, for instance. So there are Democrats who believe that they actually own the issues that Trump ran on, and they just all they need to do is convince people of it.
The election results were muddled enough that you can take whatever you want out of them in order to sleep better at night. Donald Trump was elected president. He won the Electoral College. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 2 points. Those are just the basic examples of things that everyone uses to try to make their case of why they're right.
Yeah. You've got two senators on your list, Republican and Democrat, who took part in the 2016 race. Virginia Democrat Tim Kaine, of course, who ran for a VP with Hillary Clinton, and the Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who tried for president. How are they going to fare?
I think Tim Kaine starts with an advantage. You know, Hillary Clinton won Virginia. Virginia has been trending in the Democrats' favor, I think, over the last few years. But Republicans aren't going to give Tim Kaine a free ride. There's everyone from actually Carly Fiorina could run for the United States Senate in Virginia, former presidential candidate, former California Senate candidate, and other members of the congressional delegation are going to run there. And the thing about Virginia is that there is a gubernatorial election this year. And so that's really taking up all the oxygen in the Commonwealth right now. And so it won't be until later this year where I think attention turns to the Senate race. And Ted Cruz in Texas, you know, Ted Cruz is a very polarizing figure. I don't think Democrats have a chance of defeating him in a general election, but I think he has to be looking over his shoulder at a potential primary from a Republican who doesn't agree with his style. I think it's going to be challenging, though, to find enough Republican primary voters to the left of Ted Cruz in Texas to pull it off, but it's worth watching.
Yeah. This is so important for both parties, 2018. Remind us why.
Well, 2018, because Republicans did so well in 2016 and kind of holding their losses to a minimum, Republicans have an opportunity to get to a filibuster-proof 60-seat majority. Mm-hmm. Right now they're at 52. They need to gain 8 seats based on the map that we've talked about. The opportunities are there. And so it's critical for both sides, either Republicans getting to that 60 mark, and that has ramifications on the Supreme Court, and that's why Democrats should want to keep Republicans below that number. Mm-hmm. Democrats do have history on their side. usually the president's party suffers in midterm elections. There have been only, I believe, four times that the president's party has gained Senate seats in a midterm election. Usually it's only about a seat or two. Actually, there was one time where the president's party gained at least eight seats, only one time in the last 100 years, and that was in 1934. And so history is on Democrats' side. But this map is very favorable to Republicans.
Well, but you remind us, though, having said that, there's a caution that there's things like retirements, anything can happen. President Trump's performance in office, I mean, he made a lot of promises, building a wall, banning Muslims. If those don't come through, then it could be a different picture in 2018.
Absolutely. It's early. This is, I think, a baseline analysis, but there is a lot that's going to happen over the next 2 years that are going to impact these elections.
Yeah. Nathan Gonzalez, editor and publisher of Inside Elections, also the elections analyst for Roll Call. So, Nathan, you know, mark your calendar about 2 years. We'll check in with you.
Absolutely. Anytime.
The wife of the gunman who attacked a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, has pleaded not guilty to helping him commit the crime. The FBI arrested Noor Salman last week and charged her with aiding Omar Mateen by providing material support and obstructing the investigation. She'll appear in court next week to argue for her release pending trial. One question in the Orlando investigation has been how much she might have known about Mateen's plans. She was with him when he bought ammunition and texted with him during the attack. Her attorney says she didn't know of his plans. Meanwhile, the same question about what a wife might have known has surfaced in another terrorist attack. The new movie Patriot's Day about the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing suggests that Catherine Russell, who was married to one of the bombers, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, may have suspected that her husband and brother-in-law were making bombs and then refused to cooperate with the FBI during an interrogation. Russell's attorney found the film's depiction of his client inaccurate and unfair. Bruce Gellerman from Here and Now contributor WBUR has our report.
After the Boston Marathon bombings, Catherine Russell moved to New Jersey.
Catherine is right now, she's being a mom and she's working and she's trying to get on with her life.
Attorney Amato DeLuca has represented Catherine Russell in the 3.5 years since her husband was identified as one of the Marathon terrorists, but she's never testified in court or spoken publicly about the bombings.
I can assure you that Catherine Russell was a patriot and put her country before herself and did everything that she could do in order to make sure the government had the information it needed in order to protect the lives of Americans.
DeLuca says Russell willingly talked with anti-terror investigators 8 to 10 times. He says she was cooperative and the meetings cordial. And he's critical of the way she's depicted in Patriot's Day. He told the Associated Press, which was first to report the story, that the film was unfair and not true.
So I don't know where the makers of this movie get their information from. It's at odds with what happened.
But in several scenes, the movie repeatedly casts suspicion on Catherine Russell. As runners prepare for the start of the marathon, the film turns ominous. We see her in the Tsarnaev Cambridge apartment caring for their infant daughter.
You want to go get your drink? You thirsty?
Yeah, let's go. Come on.
Russell walks by the bathroom as her husband, Tamerlan, cuts off his beard. Then she glances at her brother-in-law, Jahar, who's watching an Arab-language video of a bomb being assembled. Russell is within earshot as Tamerlan confronts Jahar.
You're my brother. You understand that?
Yeah.
Are you ready for this?
Yeah.
4 days after the marathon bombings, and just hours after Catherine Russell learned her husband died in the Watertown shootout, the movie shows her defiant as she's interrogated by a federal agent from a special but unnamed agency.
Yes, my husband kissed me before he left, and he will kiss me again when I see him in heaven. And you can't prove anything. Masha'Allah.
In the film, the head of the Boston FBI tries to learn what the interrogator found out from grilling Catherine Russell.
Excuse me. What do you think?
I think she knew, but you're never going to prove it. If there are more bombs out there, she'll never tell us. Good luck, huh?
I feel there's nothing
something inaccurate about that aspect of the movie.
Richard DeLauriers was the special agent in charge of the Boston FBI at the time of the Marathon investigation.
This movie was not meant to be a documentary, Bruce. I think you have to grant Hollywood a little bit of artistic license in the making of a movie that is not necessarily meant to be an exact replication of every detail of an investigation, shall we say.
Catherine Russell's attorney says before that first interrogation, her mother-in-law and sisters-in-law told her not to say anything before she got legal advice. In the film, she asks her interrogator for a lawyer, but is told she isn't getting one. We repeatedly tried to contact the makers of the movie to ask questions about how they depicted Catherine Russell in the film, but got no response. But in an interview with the New York Times, the film's director Peter Berg stood by his depiction of Russell, stating, quote, "It's just very hard to understand how a woman living in that small house could not know what was happening." Former FBI Special Agent Richard DeLauriers agrees with Berg on the overall takeaway from the movie, that Russell knew in advance about the plot to bomb the Marathon.
I'm not saying that she did know. I'm not saying that at all. I have no information that she did or didn't know. But I think one of the conclusions you could reasonably draw is that since she lived in that residence, she might have had some foreknowledge.
At the end of Patriot's Day appears a written epilogue, quote, "Law enforcement continues to seek information regarding Catherine Russell's possible involvement in the Marathon bombings. We called the Boston FBI to learn if this is true. The Bureau declined to comment." For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Gellerman.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.